History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. The internment of hundreds of thousands of Japanese Americans during World War II in what were essentially open-air prison camps is a fairly well-known story. But what's less known is that several thousand Japanese Americans were trained by the U.S. Military Intelligence Service and then sent to the Pacific to serve as interpreters, translators, and interrogators, even as their own families were being held in internment camps in America. So why aren't these stories better known? There are many reasons, but part of it has to do with the fact that after the war, Japanese Americans weren't really welcomed into veterans groups, and for the most part, they melted quietly back into society. Well, today's guest is Bruce Henderson, and he wrote a book called Bridge to the Sun that tries to recover those stories. He follows six of these soldiers who were among the first Japanese Americans to serve in combat after Pearl Harbor as they fought two wars simultaneously. One overseas against their ancestral homeland, and against the prejudice they faced back in America. The situations that these soldiers found themselves in were truly remarkable. Thomas Sakamoto was an intelligence officer who was actually on the bridge of the USS Missouri in 1945 when the Japanese Empire formally surrendered, and there were many American soldiers who looked at him in confusion, not knowing that ethnic Japanese were fighting on their side. This is one of many stories that we get into, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Bruce Henderson. Japanese Americans were, on the one hand, the most likely people for the American government to want to be fighting for them in World War II. They knew the language of a major enemy power. They could provide critical roles in intelligence, language training, translation, and, one could imagine, espionage. I could imagine that Japan would have loved to have a native population of hundreds of thousands of people in Japan who were ethnically Caucasian and spoke English as their first language or fluently as their second. And that's what America has going into World War II. But on the other hand, Japanese Americans could be seen as the least likely people to be involved in the war. They're being called to fight against their ancestral homeland by a nation that had recently decided to horribly mistreat them and act as if they were aliens in their own homeland. You open your book with Thomas Sakamoto on the USS Missouri in 1945 when the Empire of Japan formally surrenders to the United States. Can you describe this scene and how he's being pulled between these two forces?
Yes, I thought this was a very gripping scene to open the book with. I mean, it is a World War II book, and we're opening at the end of the war, which may seem rather different. But in Tom Sakamoto, who, of course, we go on through the book to find out how it was he, you know, ended up there on the ship when MacArthur took the surrender from Japan. Tom Sakamoto was a guy who, Nisei, meaning that he was born in the United States. His parents, at the time, Japanese immigrants. That means they came directly from Japan to America. But with the laws that were then on the books, none of the immigrants from the Eastern countries were really allowed to become American citizens. And in kind of a catch-22, you couldn't own land unless you were an American citizen. So it set up these immigrants to work, you know, the land, if you will, agricultural land mostly, and, you know, on the West Coast, a lot in Central California, as Tom's parents did. But also the parents, even though they really embraced this new land of theirs, America, you know, they did have strong ties to their ancestral homeland, and they wanted their children to have some appreciation for their culture, their language, relatives even that were, of course, still living back in Japan. So Tom's parents and a lot of the immigrant parents, and even though they didn't have a lot of money, one thinks about, oh, it's traveling abroad for a semester kind of thing. No, but they sent their young children for a year or two back to Japan to live with relatives, to go to school there, to be immersed in the culture in Japan. And this is what happened with Tom. He was actually there for 4 years, high school years, went to high school in Hiroshima and where his relatives lived. And then when he graduated high school, he was an honor student and And he was in what was their equivalent of their ROTC program in the high school there. And upon his graduation, he was offered a commission in the Japanese Army. And of course, this was before the World War II started. This was in about 1936, seven, around there. And he, of course, turned it down. He said, you know, I'm an American. I'm going home now. And he did. He came back to the United States. And so he ended up in the Army. He ended up being drafted just shortly before the war and was actually in the Army already when Pearl Harbor was attacked. So he didn't really have a conflict when it came to his patriotism. He considered himself an American first and foremost. He was born here. This was his country. He loved it. Japan was the homeland of his parents and his ancestors. But that said, you know, what a tremendous conflict of emotions. And his parents were, as he stated after the Pearl Harbor attack, his parents really were ashamed at what their country, Japan, did to this country, to America. And but they told Tom, they said, Tom, America is your country. You fight for America. And he set out and we follow him through the entire war. He was trained early on in the military intelligence service. They understood the value of his language skills. I mean, this is not somebody who can just, you know, order dinner in Japanese, but he went to school there and he knows everything, all the cultural references and the slang and, you know, whatever it, you know, he's this dual citizen, if you will, dual person. And so he was very valuable to the U.S. Army. And the Army, when World War II broke out, we had a lot more people who knew German. And we were really kind of covered on that front, if you will, with translators and interrogators and whatnot. And we had far fewer Americans, if you will, Caucasians that really knew Japanese that well. There are thousands and thousands of characters in Japanese to be able to read the language, something like 20 or 25,000 characters that really have to be memorized. And it's one thing to be conversational. It's another to be able to read and write Japanese. And of course, Tom could do that. And so he ended up not only going through this school himself as a student, learning military terms, but then stayed to teach other Nisei who were being recruited by the Army secretly to go into the Pacific. And the reason I say secretly is because we really didn't want the Japanese, our enemy, to know that we were going to have language skills in the Pacific, that we were going to have teams of Nisei who could understand their language, both written and oral. And the Japanese were very arrogant about the difficulty of learning their language and their reading and writing of it. And the Japanese Army sent a lot of stuff in the open, meaning without even taking the time to code it, just straight Japanese, thinking that, oh, there's not going to be anybody in the, none of the Marines here on Iwo Jima are going to know what we're saying, you know? Well, wrong, because we had these military intelligence teams of about usually 10 or 12 Nisei who were listening to the radios, who were interrogating prisoners who were there. But again, we didn't want to make that well known. So it was not something that was advertised or written about or boasted about or anything. And so Tom stayed in this school for about another year and taught some other students who then were deployed into the Pacific. And then we follow him in the book in terms of he goes to all of these various battles, some of the really iconic battles that we know about. I mean, these guys were everywhere, these Nisei. They were at Iwo Jima, they were in Burma, they were in Okinawa, they were at Leyte, they were everywhere. And we really, you know, didn't know that and went many, many, many decades without knowing that. And that's what I chose to write about in Bridge to the Sun. But when Tom is on that ship getting that surrender from the country of Japan, you know, he's sad for the people of Japan that he knows that they have been bombed and they've really suffered. He's angry at the Japanese military for what they put their own people through, let alone, you know, some of the things that they did on the battlefield. And so he was one of as it turns out, we have these pictures, of course, of on that ship when MacArthur's taking the surrender, and, you know, literally thousands of American servicemen. And Tom Sakamoto was one of only three Japanese Americans there that day during the surrender ceremony. And I just thought it was a really emotional opening for the book.
I'd like to look at some of the context of what's going on before Tom Sakamoto and others enlist in the military. The internment of Japanese Americans is well known, but could you describe this process, but then also parallel to this, the U.S. government is opening the Military Intelligence Service Language School. Is there a sense, I suppose, from the vantage point of the government of these two being in conflict, or is it the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing?
Well, probably a little bit of both, Scott. The Pentagon, the government, after Pearl Harbor, as you know, did, you know, round up over 100,000 Japanese Americans, mostly from the West Coast states, feeling that they were a security risk, that they should be, you know, held in these camps. And not only were these Japanese immigrants, like the older folks I told you about who came over and but couldn't become citizens, even those who wanted to, but also their children, like Tom, who were born here as and were as American as, you know, anyone else born in the United States. And they were rounded up as well and went into the camps. In fact, over half of the about 110,000 Japanese who ended up, ethnic Japanese who ended up in the internment camps, were American citizens. So, you know, the Army, and I should say the Army, the military, didn't really understand. They looked at them all as an equal threat. But somebody somewhere, and I must say, I did look at this. I did try to find this. You say the left not knowing what the right's doing. It's very, very true. Somebody somewhere got smart in the Pentagon, in the War Department, as it was called then, and said, well, wait a minute, we need Japanese language skills. And we've got all these young, you know, Japanese speakers in camp. And in some cases, they had them in. Oh, and I should point out those that were in the Army before Pearl Harbor, like Tom, and there were, you know, a lot of them, because the draft had started about a year before Pearl Harbor. But a lot of them were kicked out of the Army after Pearl Harbor, even though they needed them. They were kicked out of the Army. And Tom wasn't. He was one of the ones that, you know, immediately was shifted into this language school. But so somebody somewhere said, oh, let's go to the camps. Let's go to the internment camps and recruit these guys. Okay, so on one hand, you've got what, a 20, 21-year-old Japanese American in this camp with his mother, his father, his grandmother, his younger siblings. And here comes two white Army officers into the camp to say, we need you. You know, your Uncle Sam is calling you. Well, Uncle Sam put them behind barbed wire and, you know, with gun towers and with machine guns on top of them. And though, by the way, those guns were pointed not outward, but pointed inward. And as they looked up at the gun towers, they all knew what that meant. You would get shot if you tried to escape. And so there was real conflict in the camps. Some of these guys and a number of my characters in the book who we follow in the war stepped forward and volunteered. Yes, I want to fight for America. Yes, I'm, you know, I will do this. And they were recruiting them for the military intelligence. Others, as you might well imagine, other young men in that camp said, go to hell. You've put me in this camp, you know, and with my loved ones. And why should I come and fight? So there were really political undercurrents. Now, most of the Nisei, again, those born in the United States who had the opportunity to go into the armed forces and fight for the United States in that war, did so. But there was an element, you know, there was an element that demonstrated in the camps and didn't like how they were being treated. And one honestly can't blame them.
It must have been very challenging to balance these competing loyalties, but many found a way forward. And it's worth looking at the particular stories that you chronicled to see how they do this and, in the midst of a war, do their best to serve. We looked at Tom Sakamoto. Can you tell me next the story of Nobuo Furuye, and I'll probably mispronounce names here, but listeners know that's par for the course. Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. But first, I want to give a shout out to all the great shows on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including Key Battles of American History. You can find this show and many other great ones like it by going to ParthenonPodcast.com.
Yeah, Nobuo Furuye. So he volunteered right after Pearl Harbor when he ended up going into the language school. Who did he find there teaching? He found Tom Sakamoto, who he had gone to high school with in Japan, because Nobuo's parents had sent him as a young boy to go to school in Japan as well. And so, you know, it was kind of like old home week. I mean, here we are. You know, we were in Japan together, and now here we are in this, you know, language school together. And so it was with Nobuo, these guys who went to school in Japan were actually called Kibei, K-I-B-E-I, Kibei. Although they were Nisei, the Kibei is a Nisei person who goes to Japan and goes to school for some period of time and then returns to America. So they're an American citizen, but they've gone to Japan. So he was Kibei. And I should say that as far as the army was concerned, you can understand the Kibei were the most valuable because, you know, immersed in the language and the culture in Japan, whereas a young Nisei, say, growing up in Fresno, California, who had never been to Japan, he would be conversational in Japanese, and maybe, you know, his parents would have Japanese newspapers around the house and whatnot, but wouldn't have the same skill set as somebody who either went to high school or a year or two of college, as some of them did in Japan. Now, the thing about Nobuo that's interesting is that when he graduates from the language school, he's thinking he's going to go to the Pacific, the South Pacific. And where do they send him? They send him to Alaska. We're trying to retake the islands of Attu and Kiska that the Japanese had occupied. And we're, of course, in the shadow of Alaska. And we're really, you know, that was the closest that the Japanese got to continental United States. And so he was part of that operation and of retaking those islands in the Aleutians. And so after that, Nobuo then goes into the Pacific, and he's actually, again, somebody that we followed through these iconic battles. And he ends up becoming engaged during the war to a Nisei woman from Los Angeles. And then she ends up being rounded up and going with her parents into a camp. So even though his own parents in Colorado aren't being held in the camp, the woman he loves is in a camp. And here he is, you know, fighting for the country that has his fiance behind barbed wire.
How does his story resolve, as much as you care to explain and perhaps not spoil the ending?
Well, the ending, I don't know. I think I don't usually tell people the ending of the book, except that he goes through a lot. I mean, he goes through, they all do. They go through these incredible battles. The thing I want to say, too, is you might think that a team of 10 Japanese Americans, but looking obviously very Japanese, because they are ethnic Japanese, both parents are Japanese, being assigned to a Marine Corps division, an Army combat unit, Merrill's Marauders in Burma, who were famous for taking no prisoners because they were fighting in a brutal jungle adversary who did not take prisoners. And so now here come these 10, 12 Nisei on this language team. How are they treated and how are they looked at by the other American soldiers, the regular GIs? And I have to say that to a man, the vets who I talked to, the Nisei vets who I talked to, said there was never a whisper of trouble. And part of what the GIs were told by their sergeants and their officers was, these guys are not only as American as you and me, but when we get over there or in our next battle, we're going to really need these guys.
they can help us. They can not only help us, you know, beat the enemy back, but they can help us save American lives. So in a lot of units, they were really protected. And it was understood that if, you know, if you lost one of them or you lost a team of them, that this combat team could be seriously affected. And so they were even more than accepted. They were really honored and appreciated. And I thought that was an interesting dynamic.
Are there other stories that really stick out to you? Their service, whether on the field, providing critical intelligence, that really surprised you as you were considering the role of these intelligence officers in the war?
Well, there's the story of Hiroshi Matsumoto, also known as Roy Matsumoto, his American name. He went and fought with Merrill's Marauders in Burma, and he actually was credited with saving his battalion, which one very crucial point had been surrounded on a mountaintop by superior enemy forces, and days after days of being pounded with mortars, and the Japanese were setting up to do an assault to wipe these guys out. And so, but they didn't actually know, the American commander didn't know when they were going to attack or where. And he couldn't, you know, if he should he protect the south side or the north side of this hilltop, and, you know, and how to do it. So Roy one night took off his pack and helmet and volunteered to crawl through the brush and get as close as he could to the enemy lines to see if he could overhear what they were saying, because there was a lot of activity going on and there was some feeling that they were possibly going to attack in the morning. And Roy took with him two hand grenades. And as he explained it to his lieutenant, one of them is for them, and then one of them is for me, because I can't be captured. And that's another thing is, you know, these Nisei who fought for us, I mean, they understood that if they were captured, they weren't going to be treated like a regular POW. And even regular POWs were treated badly in the Pacific by the Japanese army. But these guys were going to get special treatment, and it wasn't going to be, you know, they weren't going to survive, and they knew that. And so they weren't going to allow themselves to be taken prisoner. So anyway, he crawls through the brush and gets close enough. And there's a lot of discussion about what we're going to do in the morning. And the Japanese troops are excited, and they're drinking some sake and doing some, you know, bonsai stuff and everything. And he comes back with this information as to where they're going to hit. And so the Americans actually abandon their foxholes in this one area, and they set these booby traps with hand grenades into the foxholes. And then they back further up away and get their fields of fire all adjusted and everything. And then sure enough, in the morning, the assault happens. And the enemy troops, you know, as they jump into these empty foxholes, are blown up, and they're not seeing any Americans where they're expecting them to be. And so then they're coming further up the mountainside, and then suddenly the Americans open fire from these very advantageous positions. And they pretty much wipe out the first wave, if you will, of the enemy assault. And then there's another wave behind them, and they start up the hill, but then they see what's happening. And so they stop, and they start to turn around to go the other. And Roy stands up and starts yelling. He remembers because he is another guy who went to school in Japan and took part in their Army Reserve training there and everything. So he knows all of the Japanese Army military commands. So he stands up and he's yelling, like in his Japanese, obviously, to charge, you know, to do this, to do that. And the officers in the front ranks have already been mowed down on the enemy side. And so these soldiers, the enemy soldiers, just turn around and they come up the hill, and they're actually obeying Roy's orders to charge into the American fire. And so this assault, this enemy assault, gets completely defeated, smashed. The American battalion survives the night, that day, and gets relieved the next day. There's reinforcements that make it up to them and get them out of there. And so for years after, when they would have these reunions for Merrill's Marauders, Roy Matsumoto would always be honored as the hero of the battalion and for saving us. And the way he did it was, you know, he knew how to command the Japanese troops in their own language.
It makes one wonder, were these sorts of, I guess you could say, counter-espionage tactics common? This one was impromptu, but if you have soldiers who are ethnically Japanese, speak Japanese, then these are the sorts of tools that are in your toolkit. Are actions like this common, or are they few and far between?
Why in this specific, in terms of, you know, in the middle of an attack and whatnot, I think that's fairly uncommon. But what was a lot more common, the Japanese soldiers were all kept diaries. And what's interesting is American soldiers were not allowed to keep diaries. I mean, they could get in big trouble if you were found to be writing things down in a diary. I mean, even, you know, their letters home, of course, were censored. But if you write into a diary information about, you know, where you're at, what your troop movement is, whatever, and then you have it in your pocket and you get captured, then the enemy has it, or you get killed, the enemy can take it out of your pocket and know a lot about your unit, right? But for some reason, the Japanese army, they didn't prohibit their soldiers from doing that. So one of the most valuable battlefield intelligence, pieces of intelligence, were these individual soldier diaries that were being collected off of the dead bodies of enemy soldiers and brought to the language team, you know, in their tent, their foxhole, wherever they were. You know, they would read them, they would translate them, and they got a lot of information about, you know, not only the numbers of strength, how much ammunition they had, whether all their officers were killed, whether they had enough food or their stuff. And it was really valuable stuff. And then you combine that with what they were able to hear over the radio. And by the way, this Roy Matsumoto, who gave those commands to the enemy troops as they were coming up the hill, also in Burma, climbed up a tree and tapped into a telephone line and for about 10 or 12 hours overheard conversation between Japanese soldiers. And at one point, a sergeant who was in charge of guarding, a Japanese sergeant who was in charge of guarding a big ammunition dump site supply area, if you will, was saying, asking his headquarters for reinforcements because he only had 3 men to guard it. And they asked what his position was. And he gave the position, you know, on the map where he was. And Roy wrote it down, came down out of the tree, passed the information on, and they radioed it out. And within about 4 hours, the plane came over and dropped one bomb, you know, right on the ammunition dump, and the whole thing went up. And so that was, you know, that was, again, from overhearing the language.
This really does fill in the gaps, because when I've read accounts on World War II in the Pacific, there are points that you made earlier that the Japanese didn't code their communications. The code was quickly broken. But that's more of a story of the, you know, American intelligence getting one over the Japanese and working more effectively in that way. But it doesn't come down to the human stories that there were men on the ground who were doing the translating, who were finding ingenious ways to get access to Japanese communications and making this possible. It's almost as if it's an impersonal, inhuman machine when it's not. I mean, there are a lot of other characters and stories that you get into. Are there any other that stick out, or others whose stories we couldn't get to, that Grant Hirabayashi or Kazu Komodo? Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, another story that I like very much is Kazu Komodo. You mentioned him. He was also, again, one of these Kibei who was sent to Japan to go to school for a couple of years and then came back and then joined the, I think he also, as I recall now, was drafted shortly before Pearl Harbor. And then right after Pearl Harbor, he and other Japanese Americans who were already in uniform had been drafted, were sent to this location in Southern California all together, as if they were, you know, being rounded up. He wasn't sure what was happening, whether they were going to be kicked out of the army or what. And so, but it turns out they had him guarding some railroad crossing or something or other. And then from there, they had him go down. They took these fellows down to Southern California and were using him as guards outside an aircraft manufacturing plant. And one day, a newspaper reporter and photographer happened to come and to be visiting the aircraft plant. And Komodo was out guarding the out at the front gate on sentry duty. And the paper, the newspaper the next day had a big headline and a photo of Jap guarding aircraft plant. And so he got called in to his commanding officer, who said, I'm not going to be able to put you on the front gate anymore because of this. You can guard the back gate instead from now on. But he ends up going into the South Pacific early on, and at the Battle of New Georgia, which is in the Solomon Islands, and he's wounded and shot in the leg. And he comes home and is recuperating for about a month in the hospital, and then gets 30 days leave to go visit his family. Well, his family's in an internment camp in Arizona. And so he's on the bus and he gets off at the little town outside the camp. He decides he wants to stop and bring some food in, some meat and some fresh produce and stuff that he figures maybe his family's not getting in the camp. So he goes into this little grocery and goes back to where the butcher is. And he says, yes, I'd like this beef here. And the butcher looks at him and says, I don't sell the Japs. And Komodo had his uniform on, and which, by the way, also had his blue heart, his purple heart on for being wounded in combat. And Komodo said, I'm not a Jap. I'm an American. And the butcher looks at him and says, sees his uniform and sees his medal and says, okay, what is it you want? And he gets his meat and gets back on the bus and goes and visits his family. But even coming back from what he came back from, he's slapped in the face with, you know, the reminder that not everybody's welcoming him home.
Right. And you conclude the book with an interesting point that part of the reason these stories aren't as familiar to us is that with the formation of veteran groups after the war and all of the education that went on thanks to these groups, with veterans visiting schools, libraries, giving speeches and talks at different civic organizations, Kiwanis, Lions Club, whatnot, for many years, and even up to this day, to those nonagenarians that are still out there telling the stories of World War II, a lot of Japanese Americans weren't welcome into these organizations, so they weren't around to be able to tell their stories in the same way. What do you hope that is remembered from their stories?
Well, I think for me, the takeaway is, first of all, these guys, these Nisei, they were fighting two wars simultaneously. I mean, as if one wasn't bad enough, but they were fighting one overseas against America's enemies, and they were fighting the other at home against racial prejudice. And what they knew then was that only by winning the first one would they be able to come and try to overcome the second one. And, you know, have they? Did that happen? No. And I think that's part of what, you know, of course, we're seeing today. There's still a very strong anti-immigrant vibe in this country. And, you know, if you look different, sound different, then you're different. So I hope that we realize that patriotism comes in all shapes and all colors.
Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot more details included in these stories that we couldn't get to. And for listeners who want to check that out, the name of Bruce's book is Bridge to the Sun. Bruce, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, that is all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes for this and all my other episodes and include sources, maps, or other relevant information, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. Parthenon is the name of the podcast network that History Unplugged is a part of, along with other great history shows like James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. This really helps the show grow. The second thing is to join our membership program on Patreon. And if you do so, you can get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog of the show, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.